So welcome. This is May 2nd, 2009, and this is the PAFRC teleconference on PAFRC Lecture 72, About the Fear of Loving. So welcome to you all. When I work with people, I like to start with the positive. So you've got a lecture title that says About the Fear of Loving. And it's very easy to focus on the fear, which is what we will do because that is the problem. But before we do that, I'd like to spend a few moments to stress the positive because it can get forgotten. I don't spend a lot of time on it, but it's important to remember. So in my usual joking way, you're on this teleconference because you care about something. This lecture may not be your favorite, but you care about something. You're here for a reason. You are called to explore or investigate. You're on a spiritual path that may include some of the PAFRC lectures. You've got an interest in learning. So when I say spiritual path, that encompasses every aspect of who you are. And you have an interest in life. And by life, I mean that you're not satisfied with negativity in your life, whether it is a large portion, and for some of us when we're in crisis, it is a large part. There are time periods where the whole, it looks like a very, very huge, deep, dark storm. And then there are time periods where most things are good, but a few things bother us. But they're relatively minor. Either way, if you're on a spiritual path, if you're reading spiritual books and listening to spiritual tapes and doing whatever you can, there's a positive intentionality there to change. If you're in stasis, if you're stuck, there's a desire to free yourself. If you're in contraction or feel that you're overwhelmed with negative events, you're looking for turning that around to the positive and going into some form of expansion. So I know that whenever anybody comes to me, what I find is that I hold a real solid view of the positive, and I sometimes forget to communicate that. So I thought I would start there. Let's start with the positive of About the Fear of Loving, and that is that we want to love, that we're interested in what would hold us back, even if we don't feel it in our daily lives. So I want to keep stressing this, that just because you don't feel it doesn't mean it's not happening. And just because it's a small part of your life does not mean that you don't have the right to focus on that. So I call it cranking down the microscope. So if you've got a fairly good life and you look around and say everything is good, let's call that 10x magnification. What people do is they crank up the magnification. They look a little deeper. Because they've got the time and they've got the emotional reserves to do so. So when you crank up from 10x to 100x, you see a lot more. And for a period of time, this can be overwhelming. You can really feel like you've opened the floodgates. Oh, my God, what is this? Simply because you've opened a level of awareness and you've opened up two aspects of spirituality that you haven't seen before. Well, if you haven't seen them, they're cluttered. They have cobwebs. They have dust bunnies. They have you've been storing things there that you didn't even know about. So there's a quality in our lives of once we turn to address something, we might realize that it needed more attention than we anticipated. And we want to hold the positive at that point. But that's simply the overwhelm of awareness. But without awareness, you really can't do anything. So I'm going to stress again the importance, I feel, of Lecture 127, which is the four stages of evolution. And what Lecture 127 talks about is that we're in a period that the guide calls automatic reflex, which is basically being unconscious of what's going on around us. Now, that is not your entire life. Different aspects of your life are in different stages at different times. This is a fluid, organic thing. It doesn't never get stuck. So in the first stage, as described, you've got automatic reflex. The second stage is massive, and it is awareness. And again, it's not all or nothing. It's a process. So there's an opening of the eyes and a realization as you look around of what's going on. But at that stage, you do not have understanding. Understanding is the third stage. Understanding starts the moment you open your eyes. But it takes a while because you need awareness to trigger you into searching or talking or seeking or getting information. So there's a, like walking, there's one step and then the other, and one step and the other, and then you get into a cadence where walking becomes easy, and you can walk quickly or slowly, you can skip, you can run, you can jog, but there's always a 1-2, awareness, which leads to understanding. When the understanding is complete, you slip into a knowing, and in that place, you may not need to work on that area for a period of time. You may never need to work on it again. So for some of you, you may have slipped through some of the parts of this lecture that are discussed. You may have slipped into knowing about them. But there may be other sections that you have not. So I want to stress that this is very, very fluid. So when we talk about the subject, for some of you, you'll get 3% of information from this lecture. For others, you'll get 60%. In terms of level of interest. That's probably a silly way to describe the percentage, so please let that go. But what I'm getting at is that even if you read a lecture where you feel that you have a knowing, a deep knowing, and the lecture reflects a part of your life that works very, very well, you may never go back to the lecture, but what's being expressed to me by people is that it's very gratifying to read in words what you may have known but not have personally been able to express. So in all four areas of the four stages of evolution, the lectures can be read and they can be useful. Now the funny part is in automatic reflex, you may read it but not get it. It's as if you're dumb as a post. You read it and say, I don't get it. Another thing that can happen when you're in automatic reflex, and what that means is you're unconscious of the connection with the lecture. You hear the words, but they're not coming in. So you can read it and say, I simply don't understand. But you can also be reading and just realize that you're on page 5 and you really haven't taken it in. And you start over, but it doesn't come in. Now, at its worst, what happens is you fall asleep while reading the lecture. In the tapes of Ava giving her lectures, sometimes you can hear people snoring because a lot of people fell asleep while she was lecturing. And what the guide said was, let them be unless they're disturbing you because they may need to not be conscious to hear my words. In other words, when the people were going into this state of unconsciousness, it wasn't really sleep. The personality got out of the way, and the words could go in. But there wasn't yet a connection between the unconscious and the conscious. And when that connection happens, that's called awareness. So if you read the lectures from a place of automatic reflex, you may feel a nagging sense of, I'm not getting it. It's still useful to read. There's something going on. There's a connection there. If you read it in awareness, the lecture can feel very painful. It feels like there's a joke about freshman doctors, freshmen in medical school, and as they read each disease, they start seeing the symptoms in themselves, and they think they have tuberculosis and arthritis and all these terrible diseases because they're learning, well, what's an ache and what's a problem. And the same thing goes with spirituality. You can read something and think, oh my God, that's me, that's everything. And I'm inviting you to see that that could simply be a sensitivity, because you have come into a lot of awareness about it, but you haven't quite found your feet yet. You haven't quite found a beginning of understanding yet. So awareness is a very, very painful stage, but it's absolutely necessary to go into the next couple of steps. So when I do these presentations, I know you can read the lectures. I know that you can get a percentage. I don't know how much. And what I focus on is helping you connect a little bit more deeply with what the lectures mean in terms of real life. What does it feel like? What does it look like? The guide does an extraordinary job of doing that, but there's only so much time, there's only so many words, so much paper. So that's what I hope to be able to add to this. So that's a summary of the four stages of evolution and how you might see where it applies to you on a given lecture. So starting again with the positive, that you've got a positive intentionality if you're doing anything regarding spirituality. Secondly, there's a positive in the sense that even if you stumble, even if you fail X amount of times, even if you're not adept at this, it's important to honor the soul movement. And by soul movement, what I mean is you may have an eros to learn something. And the phase of learning is very difficult. When we're learning something, we don't do it instantaneously, perfectly. So my invitation is to hold yourself with love here, because you may be in a new space. You may be seeing things from a perspective that you haven't seen things before. And it needs a little practice. But if you can simply rely on your positive intentionality and allow the soul movements being eros towards something, or thoughts, not thinking, not intellectualism, but thoughts, free-flowing thoughts, and of course feelings. If you're attracted to something, if you enjoy something, see if you can honor that. Now at the same time, we look for other things, because you can enjoy something but it's got problems or it takes you away from your work. This is the reality of everyday life. And each one of us will find a different balance with this. But if we honor the positive, then we'll do what we can as often as we can. And I invite you to see where that leads you, rather than worrying about how much further you should go or that you don't understand certain things. It will come. That is my experience. It will come. So the third aspect of staying with the positive is that negativity ultimately is boring. It can be juicy and fun for a while because it's naughty and dangerous, and because you get reactions out of people, and because it makes negativity can make you feel powerful. It's like you punch people out with your emotions or your anger or your irritation. You fluff the feather bed. You shake the doona. And you move things, and that feels better than being still and stuck. But ultimately, there's not much point to negativity. So when people are in a negative phase, when they're full of anger and rage, it's important to go ahead and not allow them to let it go, but to understand that there's a pent-up quality there that needs to move. And the movement is positive. The movement of negativity will ultimately run out of steam. It can't last. It's boring. Guide says that in the lecture on the plan of salvation. He says that the ultimate inevitability of salvation is, where else are you going to go? You can only be with the devil for a while. The real work and the real excitement and the real passion and eros comes from finding our divine center, and that's not part of the negative experience. The other thing is that negativity tends to be stasis or contraction. Now, there's also an expansion quality, but it's more of a forcing current quality. And only having two things to do is boring. So if you're stuck, there's a positive quality to being stuck, and that is eventually you will want to move. So stuckness can be a spiritual experience. And contraction, how far are you going to contract? And go into a black hole, and then what do you do after that? Whereas life is about all three. I describe life as like breathing. You breathe in, you expand. You breathe out, and your chest contracts to push the air out. And most of us have one or two places in that cycle where we pause, and that is stasis. But you can't hold stasis in your breathing and live. You cannot expand forever, and you cannot contract forever. So I offer this as something that was taught to me as a very useful model to look at life with, that there will be periods of expansion, and they will alternate with some contraction. And there may be periods of stasis. Stasis is not quite the same as stuck unless you stay there too long. So again, what I'm talking about is I'm talking about seeing the positive in whatever work you're doing, instead of judging or worrying or fearing that you're in the wrong place at the wrong time doing the wrong thing. So this is where the guide says your life does not lie and that the plan is perfect. And I think that that is a concept that underlies this lecture, and I'll bring that up a couple of times in this. So that is starting with the positive. And the guide starts the lecture by talking about the fact that the issues about the fear of loving emanate from the immature parts of us. And by that he means that maturity, the ability to love, is a sign of maturity. And vice versa, maturity allows you to love. And the dilemma with loving is that as a child, we feel that we have to have love to live, and there's a reality in that. It is true that we have to have love to live as a human being. As a child, we see other people being able to give love, and we may not perceive ourselves as capable of giving. We may not have that consciousness yet. So we perceive other people as able to give love, and we need love to survive. Therefore, our job becomes to get love. And so there's a natural evolution in a child of recognizing the positive of love and trying to gain it or magnify it. So if we get a little bit, it's yummy, and we want more. And if it's yummy and we want more, we start seeing where other people seem to have the ability to take love away from us. And this translates to, oh my God, I'm going to need to assure that I get enough of what I need. Remembering that we're talking about a child consciousness here. But the perfection of being a human being is we all go through that. We just don't become little Buddhas, most of us, when we're three. We're usually going along one version or another of the same levels of development. And some of us get into more trouble than others, but that's just the breadth of our experience. So as a child, we see that what we must do is we must get love, we must control it, we must grab it, we must get people to give it to us. And what that generates is a sense that they have to surrender to us. And if we believe that they must surrender to us so that we can get love, on an unconscious level, we may believe that for us to give love, we need to surrender. And perhaps you can see the confusion that this causes. So the getting of love, the reaching out and trying to grab it, that's a power move. Surrendering is not seen by the child as a power move. The child's experience of surrender will result in nothing. So the guide talks about love, to some degree or another, is a matter of surrender. Love is about giving without a forcing current, without a demand, without an agenda. It's simply love. And in that action, we are not attempting to gain power over another. And that is a surrender. And that it is very hard for the child consciousness to understand that. That's an adult thing. It's a long-term goal. And children, just their heads are not designed like that. They aren't developed enough to see the long-term goal. It's like, eat your vegetables and you'll be healthy. It just doesn't work for kids. So we want love. And the human development is to learn that there's another step to that. It's like, that's the step one, we want love. And step two is we both want to give love, and to get, you have to give. I don't know whether that's chicken and egg stuff, but there's a place where some of us learn to love because we can't get away with not loving. Okay, we don't come willingly to the table. We come because that's the game and we have to play. But that's okay, too. That's like a learning stage, a place where you do it by rote before you do it out of your heart. So I remember as a child, my mother wanted me to write thank you notes. And as a child, I just didn't know how. Sometimes the gift wasn't perfect. I didn't want to. From a child's perspective, why should I thank you? I didn't like it. Okay. From a child's perspective, I want to go play with my toy. I don't want to sit down and write letters to Auntie. And it's important as a parent to teach your child appreciation and gratitude, even though at first it will come out as, dear Auntie, thank you for the toy, love me, better than nothing. Okay. But the process of learning that builds over time. So that at some point we might sit down and write a genuinely heartfelt, loving letter to someone who went out of their way, did us a favor, gave us a gift, or made our hearts sing. So it's a process. Well, loving is also a protest. What I was trying to say was love is a process. To learn to love is not something that comes intuitively, naturally, and fully in its mature state. So in its immature state, it may need to be pulled in to loving through ritualistic thank yous and taking care of, rather than being a natural emanation of the heart, but that's okay. Now, the dilemma that I face sometimes is that people think they're supposed to grow up by the time they reach 18 or 21, and while that may be true on a physical level, on a social level, it usually takes 5 or 10 years more time before they are well ensconced in society. And on the spiritual level, it's not uncommon for it to take another 10, 20, or 30 years. So the ability to love is so massive and phenomenal and awesome that it doesn't surprise me that it would take 50, 60 years to learn, and certainly that long to master. But to master something, you have to work on it. So, of course, you would start working on it from the day you were born. So what I'm speaking of here is that the fear of loving stems from an immature place in us, a place of child consciousness, where we perceive that we have to give to get, and we only give to get. That our giving is a control play, a power play, rather than necessarily an emanation from the heart. There are always movements of love from the heart. But I'm talking about the troubled areas where we're playing a game so that we can win. And what we want to win is love. Now, the second thing that the guide goes into is submission. Because in this power game, some of us feel that we can stamp our foot and get what we want, even when it regards love. Okay, that's a personality type. I guess it works for some people. It never has worked for me. The majority of people, when they're seeking something as precious as love, tend to fall into submission, because you can step up and demand a job or your turn at bat or your place at the table or your share of the pie. Commanding love doesn't work as well as perhaps we in our immaturity might like it to work. So usually what happens is we turn into a submissive game where we're trying to con love out of the other. And any time you are, once again, in the power deal, you say, I'll give it to you because I want you to give it to me. But that's a straight upfront transaction. In submission, you're giving in order to get, but you're pretending that you're only giving. And this is also an extremely immature stage that all of us go through. I think I'm sure I did it 2 days ago, so it never quite fades away. Okay? But submission is always false. It looks unselfish because it was designed to look unselfish. It was deliberately set up to look as if we're being unselfish. And what we're asking the other to do is make a sacrifice for us, because we're not thinking of their welfare, we're thinking of how do we get the love. And we want the love like a prize. But submission is not an equal sacrifice. We're not in surrender, we're not being open, and we're certainly not giving up something that we care that much about. Submission is a way of keeping all the things you want and figuring out what you could offer. So the sacrifice is a petty kind of sacrifice. It's as if you're playing a chess game and you decide that you can give away 5 pawns, but you don't give them away because you don't care. You're sacrificing the pawns, which is a wonderful term, to sacrifice your pawn, in order to win the game. So that's what submission really looks like. It's a tactic where we are attempting to get, and we know that if we raise our fist and stomp our feet, we won't get it. So we attempt to schmooze. We attempt to convince the other person that their interests are our interests, and that we fully and completely support them. And the prize is love. What we want from them is love. Now, in both of these cases, there's not a large interest here in giving love. Part of that is due to maturity. Giving love is a very mature thing to do. But part of it is due to when your focus is on getting. Your focus is not on true giving. It's on sacrificial or fake giving. Giving to get. I'm going to pause here for a second, ask if there's any questions. Okay, we'll just go on. So the other aspect of the lecture focuses on defenses. Now, the lecture doesn't go into defenses to too much degree, and I wanted to expand that a little bit, because defenses are easy to miss, especially in the most subtle places. So I find that I don't normally deal with people who have just robbed banks. I don't normally deal with people who have just abandoned 10 of their children. There's a degree of being in life and doing things that doesn't lead to spiritual reflection. So it's not uncommon that the people that I work with are fixated to some degree. I use that in a positive sense. They're very, very tightly focused on some pieces of negativity that don't seem like much, perhaps even to others. So the defenses I'm going to talk about are a subtle form of defense. And the first one, the guide talks about submission in the lecture. And then in the following lecture, he talks about 3 different styles of preventing loving. And I'll go there in a moment. But this is all based on the triad that is formed based on lecture 43, which is the 3 personality types of reason, will, and emotion. So just for convenience, we knock that down to RWE, and then I try to build charts and so forth where I'm constantly doing the R first and then the W and then the E. So I try to put the reason quality first and the will quality second and the emotion quality third. It doesn't always work. But in this triad of personality types, and the charts are on the website, there is a corresponding type of style associated with the defenses. There is a corresponding gift associated with the different types, because types are a very crude and broad way of separating styles of operating. Nobody's a type. We're all mixtures. So sometimes on the charts, if you go down and you're trying to say, I'm like that, but I'm like that, but I'm like, you'll get zigzags on there. But to be a human being, you've got will. Will is not an option. Okay, there isn't anybody on the planet who doesn't have will. It takes will to get born, and I won't go into it, but you had to ask to be here. Asking is an act of will. And it takes some energy to stay on the planet and not just lay in the street, give up, and die. And it takes a lot of will to build a life, to furnish a home on any degree whatsoever, to find a job or a profession, to make friends, to stay connected. All of these, you can feel there has to be something that gets you up in the morning, something that moves you, something that makes you take the book off the shelf. Without will, you can't just say to the shelf, could you bring the book over here? We don't have those powers yet. So we have to get up off the couch, and we have to go over to the bookcase and find the book. And I'm sure that many of you have had the experience of, if you can't find the book, you look at another shelf, and finally you're in the closet tearing apart curtains saying, I know I have that book. That's your willpower, saying, I want this, and I will do whatever it takes to get it. No matter how quiet and calm and quiet and calm. I was trying to think of a word, but I can't come up with anything that's serious. I come up with mousy. But no matter how quiet and calm someone is, every human on the planet has will. So when we're in our defenses, the person who has a reasoned style of working with the world may tend to rationalize things. That's one of their defenses. I'm not talking about being reasonable. I'm talking about rationalizing. I'm saying that the reason type will try to make the facts fit the situation. Notice the try to make, and that's the will element. But they want a list. They want an orderly setup. They want to understand, and they don't want jarring bits of dissonance in the information that they're dealing with. The will type might over or underemphasize something. So the will type might use their will to say, this is important and this is what we should be doing. Or, that's not important. Stop. Stop that. That's not important. They're using their will in trying to influence both themselves and others about what to do and when to do it, and also what not to do. And the emotion type tends to over-dramatize or over-exaggerate. The emotion type tends to care a lot more. They whip up the caring so that they throw a lot of emphasis into something and say, oh, this is so much fun and this is so great and this makes me feel so happy. Surely this is a good thing to do. Instead of accepting that it may or may not, and it may just have a little bit of pleasure or a little bit of fun. But I'm talking about the defense. And in the defense, we use feelings. We use thought, and we use our determination in order to take things in a certain direction. So we're talking about the fear of loving. And we've talked about loving. Now we're talking about defenses. And next we'll talk about fear, but I still want to talk about the defenses for a moment. So one of the set of the defenses has to do with how your personality style operates in the world. Another defense is to compartmentalize. And all three types do this. So the first I was explaining how there might be three different ways. But from this point on, the other three defenses that I want to speak of can work with any personality type. That's just a matter of how you display the defense rather than what the defense actually is. So in terms of compartmentalizing, what I'm referring to here is that when we feel that there's an area in us that is not well developed, we may wall it off. We may segregate it so that it doesn't spill over into our life. So an example would be, if we have a problem with relationship, we might choose a work environment that is not relationship-oriented, where we're either working independently, or we're working more with linear matters, rules and regulations, rather than human interchange. On the other hand, if there was a dilemma with linear thinking, we might have to do that at some point in our lives, but we might set up our lives so that we have a lot more places where we are joyous and fun, having pleasure, interacting with others, that doesn't involve too much linear thought. This is what I mean by compartmentalizing. What happens here, and the reason I'm calling it a defense, is that it's useful to not have your weaknesses showing up every 5 minutes. But when we compartmentalize, there's a tendency to either forget about that compartment or not work on it, and basically leave it as an orphan, abandon it, ignore it, because by ignoring it, it seems like 75% of our life's in good shape. Now, why would we spend our time over here with 25% that has never worked, always aggravates us, and tends to result in failure? Why would we work there? We'll do that when we have to. So you'll have 75% of your life in good shape, and I'm only using that as an example, that percentage. And the more we ignore that 25%, the more toxic it becomes. And the bigger the chance is that it will spill over into the rest of a life. You cannot compartmentalize your life. You cannot ignore one aspect of your emotional and spiritual growth without it eventually affecting the rest of your life. This is one of the spiritual laws that I'll talk about at the next teleconference. Another defense that we use is selective memory. And by selective memory, I've never met anybody that doesn't do this. I do it all the time. You just don't remember the embarrassing parts some days. You don't remember where you made mistakes. You tend to remember the happy times. You tend to remember the positive times. Depending on your personality, another person might choose to remember nothing but the negatives. But that's not because they want to. That may be tied up with, I've just caught myself, let me run back a second. When we have selective memory, okay, it depends on what you're trying to do as to how you select it. So I started off saying that somebody might only choose pleasant memories to remember. Well, that doesn't work, because now you're only remembering a part of an event. They may be doing that because they can't handle the negative events or the confusing events. It's similar to compartmentalizing. It's just a little bit different. So in compartmentalizing, you might wall off your job, or you might wall off your taxes, but it's a whole category. In selective memory, we're going around pruning. We're taking two pieces of this event and three pieces of that event and four pieces of that event that we manage not to remember, and there's a pattern to that. So selective memory tends to fall down a pattern. Either you tend to only remember the good parts or the bad parts. Now, why would you only remember the bad parts? That goes back to over-dramatizing or over-exaggerating. There's a place where you can exaggerate your faults so much that everybody says, it's not that bad, leave it alone. And that's what we're after. It's as if we're begging for validation that we can put it down. Whereas when we remember the happy parts, that might make us more welcome to a crowd of people, more enjoyable to be around. And the more that happens, the more we're not going to be encouraged to bring up the distressing memories, the awkward memories. A lot of family stories revolve around the reality that in many families, meals are meant to be happy times. But there are problems in families. And when you have a free-flowing, open discussion around the dinner table, you're going to get a mixture. You're going to get the good stuff and the bad stuff. In a family where you're not allowed to talk about problems, the good stuff is no longer natural and spontaneous. It's all there is. So it tends to inherit a forcing current. It's all we can talk about. So if we want to talk at the table, we need to come up with something positive, or we have to put a positive spin on something, whereas normally our balance might be that there's some good and bad to it. But we've been restricted from talking about the negative. In other families, the only thing people want to do is carp and complain and gossip that feels juicy and interesting to them. And they don't want to talk about positive events or positive situations. So it can go either way. I'm talking about selective memory and how we will prune and adjust our memories depending on a lot of different circumstances. Now, why are these defenses? Because once you do that, you may actually lose track of some of this. When you compartmentalize your life, you may conveniently forget about that until you are face-to-face with it one time. When you use selective memory, you may not be able to recall the entire event easily because you haven't repeated it. As you tell the story, the fewer and fewer times you tell the events that you want to ignore, the dimmer your recollection of them could become. So this is a place where we can train ourselves not to remember. Literally, train ourselves not to know. And if you're not thinking about these things, it prevents awareness. So this is a place where we can create lack of awareness simply by setting up patterns of behavior. And the last one I want to talk about is something that I use a lot, which I tend to get excitable about some particular kinds of defenses and human behaviors. And this is one that I get excited about. So what I tease about is I know when I'm being very grabby and enthusiastic and where I have a lot of energy and passion. I call it being on my soapbox. So I identify that, and once I identify it, I tend to not be as preachy as perhaps I would be, and other people understand she's on her soapbox, just give her a minute or two, she'll get off. So this is a soapbox for me. It's a process that I have termed baselining, simply because it's handy to have a name. But the process is that we pick up the story from a convenient starting point that does not allow us to include the entire reality. And when I'm working with people, very often they'll start from the crisis. And I got home and I opened the letter and he'd left me. And that's the place they want to work from, how they felt, what happened, the argument the next day. But in baselining, I just notice that that does not happen out of the blue. And what I'm trying to track back to is a place where they can have an awareness of choice that they made that led. It wasn't totally responsible, but it led to this moment. But there's a place where we may have chosen to focus on our job to the detriment of our relationship. And 3 days later, probably not. 3 months later, maybe not. But 3 years later or 30 years later, we may have gone down a road that partially excludes our partner to the point where they're not feeling engaged with us. And one of the things people do when they don't feel engaged is they go find some place to engage themselves in. Now, you can imagine that if that took, let's use a figure of 5 years, if that took 5 years, if you go back 6 months at a time, you can still find where the other person might be acting out, and the linear story might make them look like they're doing something wrong. But the guide lectures talk about the fact that we are 50% responsible in a relationship. So I'm looking back and back and back saying, where was your part in this? And sometimes we can find a place where a decision was made from which the result that we're looking at, the crisis that we're looking at, had some level of inevitability. Because we never went back and looked at that decision, and we didn't have awareness of that decision after that point. But when I talk about baselining, I'm talking about going back far enough in the story where we can take responsibility. Now, on a spiritual level, it's one of the reasons I love pathwork, because pathwork takes the baseline back beyond conception. It takes baselining back beyond our conscious memory. And I like that because I accept the fact that life is so complicated that it may well have invisible factors that we can't know in the way that we know what grandmother said to us 3 years ago. We may not know our karmic balance on the spiritual level. So we may not realize that we're dealing with a lot of negativity, for instance, to make up for having taken advantage of people in a previous life. We can't know this. But knowing that there are invisible factors allows me personally to accept that life can be a little unlinear, irrational, confusing, because I don't have all the facts. That doesn't absolve me from responsibility. It means I can only go back so far. There are some people who can go back to age 2 in their childhood and remember things. I can't. If you go back to age 2 and you remember a lot of details about your family dynamics, it's easier to work out how you became the person you are. For other people who don't have a lot of memory before the age of 7 or 8, they have to rely upon family stories. Of course, being told by other people who may be using compartmentalization, selective memory, or over-dramatization, or any of these other things, in telling the story. So if you don't have a distinct memory of something and you're relying on someone else, there's a place where we need to hold that very, very softly, because it may have a grain of truth in it, it may have a lot of truth in it, and it also has the other person's perception. So what I'm talking about here is in baselining, what I try to do is go back to that person's conscious memory from which events tumble forward from that point on. So I speak of this in terms of how we defend from